Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 podcast network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you register for that Northwest Arkansas regional event. It's going to be that event going down in the Ozarks in the spring, April 16th and 17th in Bentonville, Arkansas. Chad and I will both be there along with a whole bunch of other people. Be a bunch of speakers for 2 days. It's going to be an Andy Gullihorn concert. And if you never checked him out, then you're missing out big time. But you need to come check him out in live and in person. We've never done a concert before, Chad, at an event. But, you know, that's what we're doing in 2021. So $65 for a 2-day event. There's going to be lots of food and hanging out. And it's going to be a good time. So go over to either Here We Still Stand or you just go to the events page over at 1517.org. Chad, what's going on, man?
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, the best thing about this conference is it's in 2021.
Yeah.
Instead of 2020.
That's true.
Just that alone means it's going to be a success.
That's right.
That's really all you need to say is it's a conference in 2021. People are like, oh, yeah, hell, I'm going to be there.
Oh, definitely. Dude, have you seen every year, you know, at the end of the year, you see all these people. I saw this last year. 2019 was ending, and all these people were like, good riddance, 2019 was terrible. Every year people do this. You'll see, like, your Facebook feed will just be filled up with people saying, you know, they'll have a dumpster with a fire in it and all this stuff. Every year was just the worst year. As much as that of you have seen in the past, it will all dim in comparison to what you're going to see on December 31st, 2020. First time ever, because I always make fun of those people. I'm like, oh, it wasn't that bad. This is just another year. Every year has highs and lows. This will be the first year where I'll be like, I agree. Good riddance.
Yeah, exactly. Have you seen the Christmas tree at Rockefeller Center?
No.
The picture that it's like a 2020 Christmas tree. It looks terrible. It's like limbs missing. I mean, it looks like it been through some sort of terrible storm, and then they erected it as the Christmas tree.
Nice.
So it's like it's iconic of the year.
Of course, you know, as soon as you say that sort of thing, you just watch. We might be like, you know, when June rolls around, we might be like, man, and we thought 2020 was bad. Like, who knows what's going to happen in 2021?
Oh, I know. I don't even want to say it aloud because I keep thinking that too.
Yeah, but you think that just because that calendar flips that magically everything gets better?
Right. Oh, well, we'll pray that the Lord has mercy on us this next year for sure.
For sure. Well, we left Goliath dead on the ground without a head and David standing over him.
Yeah, we did. I can't remember who that, there's a famous painting of that particular image. It's certainly a graphic image, sticks in your head. Not really what I think most people picture when they picture David and Goliath, you know. They picture kind of David, you know, he's got the sling in his hand or, you know, maybe something like Goliath laying on the ground after he's just been struck by the stone, but, you know, decapitated with his like bleeding head hanging from David's hand. That's not really the image we associate with this.
Oh, dude, cutting this like huge guy's head off. David's probably standing there just like all blood splattered all over him and stuff. And like,
it's a pretty gruesome scene.
Yeah.
Pretty gruesome scene. So, but that's what happened. Verse 51 says, David ran, stood over the Philistine and took his sword. That is, took Goliath's sword. No telling how much that thing weighed, and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they headed for the hills as they rightly should have. So this little shepherd boy takes down the giant. We talked about that that last time, and the typology, the foreshadowing that's going on here with the son of David, with Christ defeating the true Goliaths that face us, whether you want to talk about sin or death or the devil, which is, you know, really where you always want to go with this text. And we discussed this when we started this whole chapter about the typical way this is moralized into oblivion by everybody from, yes, secular speakers to Sunday school material. It's all over the place, you know, where be like David and defeat whatever Goliath is facing you. But, you know, if you're going to read the scriptures the way that Jesus instructed us to read them, then you're going to read this as not something for you to do, but rather something that Christ, the son of David, has accomplished has accomplished for you in another very bloody kind of defeat. But in that case, it wasn't a giant that was bloody, but it was the Son of David himself in his crucifixion that brought about the victory for us.
Yeah.
All right. So let's finish out the chapter, then we'll get into 18. So what happens after this victory? It says that the Israelite soldiers, they understandably were happy. They got up, they shout, they start chasing the Philistines all the way to the gates of one of the cities in their Pentapolis, to the gates of Ekron. And then they're killing Philistines left and right all along the way. And then they come back, and of course, the Philistines just left their camps behind, and so they plundered their camps. So typical soldier activity back then. Once you defeat the enemy, then you get to take the spoils of war home with you.
Yeah, what's interesting about this too is this didn't go down exactly the way that they were presenting it as a. They were like, okay, so we got a champion, and you got a champion, and then they'll fight, and that'll be the winner, and that'll just be the end of it. David goes out there, kills this guy, and suddenly Israel's like, we're feeling
all bets are off.
Yeah, we're feeling pretty good about our chances. No, like, I mean, so they chase them out. It's I wouldn't say it was like a breach of contract. I don't know. Maybe Israel never really agreed to that. I guess they did, in fact, send someone out there. So maybe that is an agreement. I don't know. Either way, it wasn't as simple as just your guy beats our guy and that's the end of it. They go and start killing people all over the place.
Yeah, I have a feeling this wasn't the first or last time that contract was breached. You know, it's pretty hard to hold back when you're the victor, and it's pretty hard to just stand there and be the servants, of course, when you are the one who's lost.
Yeah, and I guess the Philistines didn't. They said, "Hey, we'll be yours. You know, whoever loses, they're going to be the servants," and I guess the Philistines weren't really into that part of the arrangement either. So,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely. All right. So the chase takes place. David has his own spoils of war. He's got a Philistine head. Kind of a strange verse here. It says that David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his weapons in his tent. It's strange here because this is almost like a foreshadowing, because Jerusalem at this time is not in the hands of David. Jerusalem is still controlled by the Jebusites. It's not in the hands of Israel yet. Not exactly sure what to make of that verse, but whatever it means, I mean, it does in a sense foreshadow. I guess you could call it the conclusion of this victory. I mean, this victory is just kind of the beginning of this whole escalating series of victories that David's going to have, until finally he actually wins control of Jerusalem, establishes his capital there much, much later. This is after, of course, not just after he becomes king, but after he has established some authority and control, then he captures the city of the Jebusites. Then the chapter wraps up saying that another kind of strange part of the chapter, it says that Saul sees David going to fight against Goliath. And he says to Abner, who's the commander of his army, he says, "Abner, whose son is this young man?" And Abner says, "Beats me. You know, I don't know." And the king said, "Well, figure it out. You inquire whose son the youth is." Now, this is weird because, as we know, David has been serving in the court of Saul for some time as a musician. And, of course, he just had a conversation with Saul not very long ago saying, "Hey, nobody else is going, so I'll go and I'll kill this uncircumcised Philistine." But I think what's happening here is that it's not really that Saul doesn't know who David is. Notice he never says, "Who is he?" But rather he's asking who his dad is, or what family he belongs to. And I suspect the reason he wants to know is because part of the deal of anyone who went out to fight against this champion was that the family of that soldier would be free from taxation, free from other financial burdens. So I suspect that's what's happening here, even though it is still a little bit of a strange conversation. Anyway, David gets back, and Abner takes him to go see Saul, and he's still holding the head in his hand when he goes back to Saul. And Saul says, "Whose son are you?" And David says, "I am the son of your servant, Jesse, the Bethlehemite." So presumably that's why they had this conversation, so that Jesse and his family would receive the benefits of David's military labors. And that's the end of the chapter. Long chapter, 58 verses, significant chapter for lots of reasons. But you kind of have three different things happening here. I mean, you've got the kind of the relationship between David and David and Goliath. I mean, that's obvious. But you also have kind of this give and take between David and Saul. Yeah. Because as we talked about, I mean, who's the big guy that should be going to fight the other big guy? Well, Saul. I mean, as far as we know, he was bigger and taller than any of the Israelite soldiers, and he was their leader. So it stands to reason that if anybody should be out on the battlefield fighting Goliath, it should be Saul. But of course, he doesn't do that. And then the third contrast or comparison you have going on here is between the God of Israel and the God of Philistines. And as I mentioned, this is a theological battle as much as it is a actual physical battle that's taking place. And here, as elsewhere, God is showing his superiority over the Philistine idols. All right. Well, that's chapter 17. Anything else you want to add, or are we ready to rock and roll forward?
I think we're ready. It is interesting that, you know, you had Saul deck David out in his armor, and this whole thing goes down. And David says, "Nah, I can't move around in this. This is not how I'm going to do it." The time between David saying, "Yeah, I'm going to go do that," and Saul finally letting him, and David coming back with his head cannot be that much time. Like this, it did not take David. This was not a long, drawn out fight.
No, I mean, you got a couple speeches in there, but that's about it.
Yeah, and this thing was over quick. I mean, I only say that to say that I'm sure that they were expecting that maybe this battle will be over quick in the opposite direction. Best case scenario, maybe this battle is drug out for a little while, but I'm sure this was like a shocking thing that this battle was over this quick. And of course, I mean, they pursued everyone and they went and like all that's going on. But so I almost assume that this sort of conversation between Saul trying to figure out who this guy is, I'm sure the army's out there plundering stuff and being crazy. And he's like, Saul's trying to figure out what just happened.
Probably so. He's still in a state of shock.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guarantee you, everybody who watched David march out into the battlefield were thinking, oh man, that poor kid. Goliath's going to eat him for breakfast.
Yeah.
So both sides, I think the only person who wasn't shocked was David.
Yeah.
It's like everybody else, Philistines were like, what? The Israelites were like, what? And David's like, hey, I told you.
Yeah.
I come in the name of the Lord of hosts. So victory was going to be mine.
Yeah. Yeah. So I sort of see this sort of playing out where, like, in the midst of them pursuing the Philistines, all this stuff, Saul trying to figure out, like, who's this right. person's family? Like, what just happened here? This seems like this conversation with David is probably taking place while there's a bunch of chaos going on around them, where suddenly the men of Israel have found their zeal.
Yeah. He's basically telling Abner, hey, find out more about this kid. we need to know a little bit more.
Yeah. And the reason you know that you would think this has happened pretty quick is David's still toting around this head. And I mean, I don't think he's toting around this head for too long.
No. And we're talking about that thing weighed. Jump into chapter 18. Chapter 18 is a pretty fascinating chapter. I remember looking at it a couple weeks ago thinking, I don't know what all we're going to do with this. But the more I've studied it, there's a lot that's here. And there's some pretty key themes that are here. And I'll explain these more as we go through here. But one that's really actually the most blatant is love. Love occurs in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 verses in this chapter. Love not between like the people and Yahweh or something like that, but this is love expressed between either people toward David, an individual toward David, or a whole nation toward David, or in one case, a woman toward David. That's a lot of occurrences of this kind of horizontal love, especially in one chapter.
Yeah.
So it's pretty hard to miss, and it becomes a pretty major theme of this chapter that basically everybody loves David.
Yeah, that's sort of the theme of this chapter, right? Like, everyone's real into him.
Everybody loves David. We've already heard it once back in chapter 16, it says when David came to serve Saul and attended him, it's a little ambiguous because it just says David came to Saul and attended him. And in the Hebrew, it's and he loved him greatly. Now, most translations say and Saul loved him greatly. Possible that the one who loves the subject there is David, but chances are it's Saul who's loving him. So Saul, as we've already heard the expression, in other words, of Saul loving David. But in this chapter, we have Jonathan loving David. We have the Israelites loving David. We have his future wife, Michal, loving David. So he's a beloved character for a lot of reasons, not just because of his military exploits, but he just seems to have a charismatic personality. He just seems to, he's like one of these people. We all know people like that, where everybody seems to like them or to love them or to respect them because they're just that kind of person that has that kind of magnetic personality that draws people to them. That seemed to be a characteristic of David, especially in his younger years. So that's one of the themes. The other theme is a little more subdued, but I think it's still there. And that is that David is sort of like a second Joseph. Now, I say that because several times in the chapter, we have a verb that's usually translated something like prospered or acted wisely. So David will prosper or he will act wisely. I think that occurs three times. And then in conjunction with that, we have several occurrences of the phrase that the Lord was with David. Now, where have we heard that before? That somebody prospered because the Lord was with him. We heard it way back in Genesis, I think chapter 39. Yeah, chapter 39, where three times we're told that the Lord was with Joseph and Joseph prospered. So there is this kind of, again, foreshadowing or typology that takes place, except this time, David ends up being a second Joseph figure, one who is destined for the throne, just like Joseph was, but who starts out as kind of a nobody. I mean, he's at the bottom, in other words. He's not in as bad a situation as Joseph was in with regard to prison and all that, but you can see this upward momentum that David has toward the throne that God has designated for him, just like you see with Joseph as he works his way through divine providence up to the right hand of Pharaoh. Another one of these fascinating examples, fascinating to me anyway, where you have what's sometimes called intertextuality, where you have this play between two different texts. In this case, this interaction, this intertextuality between Genesis 39 about Joseph and then 1 Samuel 18 about David. We have examples of this all over the place where an earlier biblical figure will serve as a precursor or a blueprint for a later biblical figure. And this time it's going to be Joseph and David.
And what's also going to be interesting is Saul is going to live up to sort of all the things he said he would do, right? I mean, presumably he's going to take care of David's family. David's going to marry in, This kind of stuff. And then you have these two opposing things kind of happen where Jonathan loves David and is sort of becomes David's best friend. This is where you see Saul take the turn and Saul starts becoming jealous of David.
Yeah.
And you assume that these things are connected, that not just Jonathan loving David, but everybody loving David is sort of going to be the catalyst for Saul to sort of start not really loving David the way that he did before.
Yeah, Saul is caught in a bad place because he has a growing antagonism, growing suspicion, jealousy, and antagonism toward David, while at the same time, David is the only one who's able to give him relief when this evil spirit comes upon him. Now,
this is a bummer of a situation to be in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just imagine I don't know what the exact parallel would be, but say you've got this doctor. I mean, you cannot stand him. He's like, he's making your life terrible, but he's at the same time the only one who's able to make you better. It's not the exact parallel, of course, but I mean, just imagine whatever the situation is where you need a person badly, and at the same time you think that they're going to be your undoing.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of the situation that Saul was in here. So back to Jonathan, you brought him up. That's the way we start the chapter. So right after it says that after he had finished speaking to Saul, so right after Saul and David have this little back and forth conversation about who his dad is, it says the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. And I believe, yeah, that's the way the New American Standard and ESV translate that. The verb is kashar in Hebrew, and it's often spoken of in contexts where you basically, you tie something up. So you could translate this as bind. So I don't know why they chose knit, but maybe it just sounds more poetic. But the soul of Jonathan and the soul of David were bound together. They were tied together like the Israelites. I think it's the same verb that's used for how the Israelites were to bind the word of God to their arms and their forehead, like in the phylacteries or whatever.
I was curious about this. I actually meant to look this up, but I forgot. So I'll just ask you, and maybe you know. Is this word knit, is this the same word that is used in the Psalms where it talks about, you know, that I was knit together in my mother's womb?
No, I don't. I'm 95% sure. I looked at this last week, so it's not fresh on my mind. I looked at all the occurrences of this particular verb, kashar, and I don't think it's used in Psalm 139. I think that's a different. I think that's a different verb. I mean, it expresses kind of the same idea, you know, of this being bound together, knit together, woven together.
The only reason I was asking is because it does seem like it would have been interesting if it was the same word. Maybe this point would have been better if it was the same. But either way, I think it holds that this does seem like something that God is doing. Like,
yes.
I mean, like sure, you could say that. Oh, from that moment, I knew that like I was going to be really close with this person, or I really, you know, we became inseparable from that moment on, or whatever. But there's nothing really that here that happens between David and Jonathan. The interaction is between Saul and Jonathan. Apparently, is just kind of there. So it's not like normally, like if you became best friends with somebody, there would probably be a thing that you went through together, and you were like, from that moment on, whatever it was, like we spent that summer together, or you know, we whatever mm-hmm. it was, you know,
right,
was it summer
right.
camp, or maybe you went through some traumatic thing, you know, and from that moment on, we were. You know, someone stepped in and saved you from a bully, and then you were best friends ever since, or something like that. This seems like something a little more supernatural than that. It seems like they're in this room together, David and Saul are having this exchange, and that God has sort of attached David and Jonathan at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is by divine initiative, without a doubt. And there's a lot going on here. The more I've studied this, the more I've realized that this is a deep and a loving friendship. But there's even more kind of layers to it. So it says, yeah, they were their souls were knit together. Jonathan loved him as himself. And Saul took him that day, didn't let him return to his father's house. So David is basically adopted. He becomes part of the royal family, if you will. Jonathan makes a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. And then we have this pretty well-known scene where Jonathan strips himself of his robe. And he gives it to David, and not only his robe, but his armor and his sword and his bow and his belt. Now, what's going on here? Well, I don't think there's any way we can take this except to say that what Jonathan is doing here, he's not only loving David and he's pledging him his commitment, his friendship to him, but he's also, as it were, relinquishing any claim he has to the throne.
Yeah, that's what this looks like. This looks like Jonathan somehow knowing, nothing in the text tells us that Jonathan has any way of knowing this, unless something happened that we're not privy to. But Jonathan somehow knows that at the end of Saul's reign, it will not be him that is taking up the reign. And this is interesting. I mean, like David is sort of going to marry into the family. He is sort of, as you say, like adopted in, even as he doesn't let him leave again. But yeah, this is what that looks like. And you have to think that Saul sees this happening, that Saul is able to perceive that Jonathan does not expect to be king.
Yeah. 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 I don't think there's any way that Saul could have missed the import of things like this. Whether he saw this take place or not, he certainly knew that Jonathan and David were knit soul to soul. They were close friends. And so Saul is perceiving more and more of the direction that things are going. Well, you know, one more thing I might add here is that our English word love, of course, is capable of carrying all sorts of different connotations. You know, everything from I love ice cream to I love my wife. Well, there's a huge gap there is as far as connotation goes, but we use the same word. The Hebrew word for love is like that too. I mean, you can have it used in a kind of an emotional sense, you know, like a man might express his love for a woman. You can also, and I think this is part of what's going on here. It's also used in context where you sort of have an alliance, even sometimes a political alliance that's made between a king and another king, such as we'll have as Hiram, king of Tyre. He loves Solomon, or maybe it was David, but either way, he loves him in the sense that, at least it seems to be the sense that he has pledged his, he has pledged himself to be an ally to that king, if you know what I mean. So it's not, I'm not anyway discounting the fact that there might be kind of this, this brotherly fraternal love that's going on. But I think there's also maybe even here, this idea of Jonathan is pledging himself as an ally to David, no matter what. So there's just a lot going on here, from the removal of his weapons to clothe those, to clothe David with those, to the connection that they have soul to soul, and the covenant that Jonathan makes with David.
Yeah, and
so this is basically Jonathan stepping aside.
Yeah, and it seems like in the Old Testament that, and this is probably true even today, if you're talking about actually loving people, that love and loyalty are pretty close. Mm-hmm. Together. It's not as though you could love someone but like also not be loyal to them, right? And that's what it seems like Jonathan is doing, that Jonathan loves David and that he is basically saying that he's going to be loyal to him no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And
right.
We can say that because we know that that is in fact the case, right?
Yeah. We'll see several instances of that over the next few verses, and few chapters.
And I do think that there's something about David and Jonathan. You see this with Jesus and John as well. I don't know, maybe depending on how masculine of a dude you are, like maybe it makes you uncomfortable the way that the scriptures talk about it. But if you look at the way that it talks about David and Jonathan, or the scriptures talk about Jesus and his relationship with John, I think maybe guys are like a little more uncomfortable, like telling like another guy that they love them, even if it's their best friend, even if it's the person mm-hmm. they're close. The scriptures don't have trouble with that, it doesn't seem. They don't see this as a, you know, a chipping away at masculinity for one man to love another man, which I actually think is we're probably not better for that. Like most men might have a hard time telling another man, even if it's their best friend, that they love them. Which we probably shouldn't have that problem, because the scriptures certainly don't seem that they have that problem.
No, it's very refreshing, actually.
Yeah.
You know, that this is in no way. I mean, look at what David just did. Can anyone with a straight face tell me that there's something that's a little bit less masculine about David when he tells Jonathan he loves him? Or, you know, we've looked at the military exploits of Jonathan, too. And Jonathan loves David. I mean, these guys were becoming top-notch warriors. So there's nothing whatsoever that is diminishing of their masculinity that they say to another man, I love you. Quite the opposite, in fact. Yeah. So yeah. It's a refreshing alternative, not alternative, it's a refreshing honesty about how close two men can become, especially when they're united as David and Jonathan were, not only by kind of common interest, but also by this zealous fidelity to Yahweh that goes along with that.
Yeah, I think every man is better for having at least one person, if not several people, that you love, and that having that loyalty attached to it too, that you know that this is a person that you will, if need be, like you will be there, and if you need them, that they'll be there. That's a huge benefit. In fact, it's a bummer if you don't have some of that in your life, especially, and I'm speaking just as men, I'm sure women need this too, but I can't speak to that because I'm not one. But I know you're better off if you have a couple of dudes that you love and they love you, and attached and baked into that love is that I've got your back no matter what.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I recently watched Tombstone, And there's that great quote in there about it's Doc Holliday says that, you know, he doesn't have a lot of friends.
The guy asks him why he's doing that. And he says, because Wyatt Earp's my friend. He's doing this crazy stuff because it's his friend, right?
Yeah, yeah. And he says, I don't.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't have a lot of friends. I've got one friend, and he's right there in front of me. So where Wyatt goes, I go. Mm-hmm. And nothing's gonna stop me. So I mean, that's a great cinematic example of the kind of love that exists between men.
Yeah, yeah, and you're better off if you got some of that.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Verse 5. Let's see what happens next here. We've got a few minutes left. David went out, it says, wherever Saul sent him, and prospered. Now, this is the first occurrence of that verb prospered that I mentioned earlier, which can also be translated acted wisely. This is that Joseph word. So Saul set him over the men of war, and it pleased all the people, and it also pleased Saul's servants. So everybody's happy. He's sending David out.
Yeah, he basically makes David a general, and everyone's like, yeah, I like the guy that killed Goliath. This seems like a good general to me.
Yeah, let's promote him up all the way. He's not going to be like, eh, I'm going to make you a sergeant first. If you do okay at that, we'll you know, keep raising you through the ranks. No, we're going to make you're the guy. You're the head guy. And of course, everybody's happy about that, at least for the moment. Verse 6 says they were coming back when David was returning from killing the Philistines, and women show up. Seem like every time that women show up around David, there's going to be some problems. And sure enough, same thing we have here. So the women came out of the cities of Israel. They're singing, they're dancing. They're coming out, it says, to meet King Saul. So David's with him, of course. David's returning, but they're coming out to meet Saul. And they got their instruments. They got their tambourines and got whatever other musical instruments they have with them. And not just playing, but they're going to sing. Now, here's the kind of the funny thing about the song. You're probably familiar with the song. Here's how it goes. It's real short. Two lines. Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. All right. So you got to think about this a couple different ways. First of all, probably they should have reversed the order. Just because if they want to honor Saul, they should have put his name second. Now, I could be wrong. I honestly don't think the women who were singing this were saying to themselves, you know what? Here's an opportunity to make the king really angry.
No, this doesn't seem like it.
Why don't we elevate David over Saul?
Yeah, that's not a very prudent move.
No, all I think is going on here is they're using a typical Hebrew poetic device. This is not unusual at all, where you start, especially if you use in numerals, you'll start out with one number. We'll say like, you know, so-and-so has his 100 donkeys, but this other guy has his thousands of donkeys. Well, all you're doing is taking the first number and you're doubling it, you're quadrupling it, whatever it is. This is not an unusual poetic device, but Saul does not take it well, as we see. Saul became very angry for this saying displeased him. And he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, but to me, they have ascribed thousands. Now, what more can he have but the kingdom? And Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on.
Yeah, yeah. And the ESV just says, and Saul eyed David from that day on, which we know we know what this is like, right?
Yeah, that's a pretty good translation, actually. So what's kind of funny here is that maybe Jonathan and Saul kind of see the direction things are going. I don't know that everybody else does, but they certainly do. Saul, as I mentioned earlier, is kind of trapped. He's trapped between this, as we'll see in the next section, he's trapped between this need of David, not only the need of him musically, but also now militarily, and the havoc that David is bringing into his life.
Yeah, I mean, and Saul is, you know, exegeted the situation correctly when he looks at what's going on. He says, okay, David basically has everything, even the hearts of the people at this point. There's really only one more thing he can get, and that's everything.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, he is. He's interpreted the situation with great accuracy.
Yeah,
that's the only thing. One more thing that David could get. You know, this is this introduces what we're going to see over the next few chapters, really until the death of Saul, and that is, you know, we talk about what a huge victory it was when David took down Goliath, and I don't in any way want to diminish that. It was. I mean, it's something that is worthy of people singing about, right? And him being famous for. It's great. But that pales, that particular struggle, battle, pales in comparison with what David is going to face after this. You know, it's one thing to be like, to have a clear, defined enemy on the battlefield that you can go out and kill and be done with it.
Yeah, well, so David does this, and that's great, and heroic moment. It's not as though Saul hasn't like gone out there and won battles. I mean, he's like, I'm sure he's like, what, do you guys not remember? Like when I first showed up and I had to go out there and I was like wiping out people and.
Yeah. It's not like he's a defeated coward, right? He's got a lot of victories that he can claim. Yeah. David has faced Goliath. He's taken him down. But what David is going to face over the next few years actually is another giant that he can't just face head on and take down. It's Saul. If there's a true adversary that David faces, it's not Goliath. It's going to be Saul. It's going to be this guy that he refuses to act against because he's the Lord's anointed. Even though multiple times David could have easily taken out Saul. Saul's going to try and impale him with a spear. Saul's going to try and set it up to where the Philistines kill David. Saul's going to do everything in his power, either directly or indirectly, to take David out, even as far as pursuing him relentlessly through the wilderness. And David won't act against Saul.
It's very difficult to fight someone that you refuse to kill.
Yeah, right.
It's very difficult for David. Like, so David is going to be engaged in a long conflict with someone he refuses to hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's instructive for us, you know, because it's not always like the huge conflict that ends up being really the struggle for us. You know, it's like it's the thing we can't get away from, right? It's the Saul. It's that ongoing thing that is a burden for us. And it was that burden that inspired a lot of David's Psalms. Thank God, because now we have those. But I think it's an instructive insight into what still happens to people today. You know, it's not always like the huge, big Goliath conflict, but it's this long, drawn-out thing with Saul that ends up bedeviling us and driving us over and over to mercy because we can't get away from it, right? We can't get away from Saul. And so we're just crying out. It's kind of like Paul's thorn in the flesh, right? Lord, remove this. And he's like, no, I got you. My grace, my mercy is going to be sufficient for you.
Yeah, and I do wonder if David has some degree of empathy for Saul, because it does seem that David, he's not only unwilling to engage in conflict with Saul in that way, but that he would like to see him come around and not suffer the way that Saul suffers. So as much as David is going to suffer when he's being pursued and all this sort of stuff, I do think that you can see in the text and the way that David responds that he actually believes that Saul is greatly suffering as well.
Yeah. Yeah, there is this kind of odd element to the relationship where I think David would have been happy to remain Saul's commander in chief. Mm-hmm. Let Saul be king. I'll be the commander in chief. I'll go out and fight your battles. And when you die, I'll be king.
It is a bummer for Saul because David isn't going to kill. Like what Saul's suspicious of is that David's going to take him out and become mm-hmm. king, which of course David is never going to do.
Yeah, he goes out of his way to prove it, right?
He has no intention of doing it. Like, we could have a beautiful relationship here. I could be, like, this great general, and you could be king. And, you know, after you die, I don't know, maybe then I do become king. But I'm not going to speed that process up.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a tragedy in many ways on Saul's part. Well, partly for David, too. I mean, I guess if nothing else, it's an illustration of what kind of this almost irrational jealousy can do to destroy a person. And I think that's probably what's going on. Even when David, even when Saul hears the girl singing, you know, he's going to interpret everything negatively with regard to his relationship with David. We'll see how that pans out next week. Cause we got a spear throwing, episode coming up in verse 10 and following.
Maybe we'll find out how David's reflexes are.
Right.
All right, guys. Well, that's it. We will be back next week for more of that. Make sure you go over and register for the regional event and the general of the national conference in October. You can do both those things over at the site. Chad, I will see you next week.
All right. See you then.